It's the weekend, which means it's time for Jill on Money, the show that makes money fun and just happens to answer all your financial questions. Here's your host, Jill Schlesinger.
All right, it's hour number two of the Jill on Money show. You all stretched out? You ready? Time for the interview. I love the interview. Just always learn something from all these cool people who come on the program. Today we've got someone very special. You ready for this intro? Stand by. Sean, stand by. Sean Ellis is the CEO and co-founder of GrowthHackers.com, the number one online community for growth hackers. 1.8 million global users. 350,000 new monthly visitors. Now, Sean coined the term growth hacker back in 2010. And he speaks to startups and regular people. He's got a new book out. And guess what the title is? Oh, no, it's not called Growth Hacking. It's called Hacking Growth, How Today's Fastest Growing Companies Drive Breakout Success. Sean Ellis, welcome to Jill on Money. How are you?
I'm great, Jill. How are you doing?
I am doing well. Okay, first and foremost, define growth hacking for our audience, which may not be quite as cool as you are.
Yeah, so the definition of growth hacking is really doing the experimentation that marketers usually do in advertisements, but doing it across the full customer journey so that they can increase revenue and customer growth.
Okay, but let's say that I want to do this in my little teeny tiny company. And I'm just, maybe even I've got like a side gig that's going on. A lot of our listeners have that, small business owners. It sounds like this is something that you need like very sophisticated marketing people to help you out with. So tell me a little bit about how the normal human being would be able to employ hacking growth or growth hacking to a regular old run-of-the-mill business.
So I'll start by saying when I started doing it in companies like Dropbox, they were little tiny companies.
Really?
Now they're billions of dollars of companies. Yeah, there was less than 10 employees when I was at Dropbox, and I was the only non-engineer. So,
poor you. Have you recovered from that experience?
No, it was actually really great. That was part of it, was figuring out how to effectively work with those types of people in doing this. But to go to the question of how do you do it in a smaller company, I think it starts with just being really empathetic to your customer or the customer that you want to get into your business, and understanding how they ultimately get value from your product and the path that they go on to get that value. And so just documenting their path to getting value from your product or service or whatever it is that you're doing, and then being scientific about trying to improve that path and get more people to actually experience really good value in your product. So running experiments to make that happen. And they don't have to be super scientific experiments, but it's, you know, it could be as simple as, you know, and stores have been doing this for forever. Like a little mom and pop store might try moving something to the front of the store that's in the back of the store and seeing if that draws people in better, you know, having different signage on the front. I mean, so I think you can apply this in just about any business if you really try to look at things from the customer's perspective.
So, Sean, how important is it not to change too much at once? Because then, obviously, if you change four or five different things, you don't know which thing is attributable to the change in the growth pattern. So should you do one thing at a time?
You should. And especially in a small company where you don't have necessarily a lot of people walking through the door or people going through your website, you don't want to do little tiny changes because it's going to be really hard to see what the result is. So in a smaller company with less activity going on, you want to do really big, bold changes, but absolutely one at a time is really important.
And should you actually, all right, so way back when, 100 years ago, when I owned a small business, one of the things that people, marketers especially, used to love to come in and they'd say, like, you know what, we got to do a focus group of your customers or your would-be customers. Do you believe that that is helpful or not helpful?
I think it can be a little bit helpful, but I think the problem is that people are trying to read in, to essentially derive results from the focus group itself. Mm. And where I think like qualitative research, whether it's a focus group, a survey, or just a conversation with a single person, the idea should be to get insights that give you ideas for new experiments. So like trying to find out where someone was confused or skeptical about your offering, so that you can start to say, oh, now let's start to address a real problem rather than just being creative for creativity's sake.
You say that when you do a survey, there's something called the must-have score. What is that?
So that was kind of, that started with my sort of fear of failure when I do things. And I realized that I could be the world's greatest marketer, but if nobody wants the product, it's not going to matter. So that was my way of basically, at first, just trying to see, does anybody want this product? And so asking a question, how would you feel if you could no longer use this product? So taking people who had already used it, hopefully continuing to use it, and just asking how they would feel if they could no longer use it. And then I was looking for people who would say, very disappointed. So I gave them the choice, very disappointed, somewhat disappointed, or not disappointed. And when I started to see people who say, I would be very disappointed without the product, then I know now it's my challenge to connect the product to more people like that. So mm-hmm. The score is really just the percentage of people who would be very disappointed without the product.
Does that percentage have to be a high percentage to know that you're on the right track with either a good product or service? In other words, like if you get like a tiny sliver, but they're emphatically like loyal to you, is that a good sign or not?
Well, ideally you would have a giant,
I know.
Emphatically loyal. I think I would rather have a tiny sliver that's super loyal to you than a big group that's just kind of treats you as a nice to have. Like it starts with a single customer, a single person who says, gosh, I can't live without what you're building. And I actually had one company where I ran the survey, and originally it was only 7% of the people said they'd be very disappointed. But based on what we learned from those 7%, we were able to make some changes to messaging and the kind of onboarding, so the first experience with the product. And within a couple of weeks through a bit of experimentation, the next group of people who signed up, it was over 40% of those people.
Wow.
They would be very disappointed. Yeah.
We're talking to Sean Ellis. He is the author of Hacking Growth, but he is also the CEO and co-founder of GrowthHackers.com. Go check it out during the break. When we return, I'd love for you to talk a little bit about the crisis of traditional marketing and what's going on there, and maybe why you see where you see the future is in terms of helping people market what they are and what they're doing and how their products can drive this passion in their users or in just, you know, I say users, but it doesn't. Guys, you're listening and you're probably like, oh, my God, I don't have reams of data. You're going to be able to create that data. When we come back, more with Sean Ellis. It's Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
Back to Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger. Want to get in touch? Call or email any day, anytime. 855-411-JILL or ask Jill at jillonmoney.com.
You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, give us a holler. 855-411-JILL. Send us an email. Ask Jill at jillonmoney.com. We're talking to Sean Ellis. He is the author of Hacking Growth: How Today's Fastest Growing Companies Drive Breakout Success. He's also the CEO and co-founder of GrowthHackers.com. And you know what, Sean? I figured I kind of skipped up because I was into like the content of the book without finding a little bit more about like who you are and how'd you get here? So tell us a little bit about yourself. When did you graduate? Did you go to college? What'd you study? How'd you get into all this?
Sure. Yeah, I graduated from college in 1994, mm-hmm. and immediately moved to Eastern Europe right after I graduated. So I went to Budapest, Hungary, and pretty quickly within a couple of years had taken essentially some sales commissions that I got. I was in a sales job originally and invested them all into an internet company in 1995. So if you're going to go all in, that was the year to do it into an internet company.
Fantastic. So and is it an internet company that I've heard of?
It became a top 10 internet company in the world in terms of like total usage time. So it was a company called Uproar.com.
Uh-huh.
We were based in New York, and it was the number one game site at the time. And we sold it in 2001 to a French company. But that's kind of what kicked this off for me. I'd put all this money into this company and quickly found myself tasked with trying to grow the customers on there. And you know, unlike a lot of marketers where, you know, maybe worrying about what the perception was internally of my job, I was really focused on let's make sure this thing survives. And so really ran marketing from customer zero until we became a top website in the world, and have kind of been doing that ever since.
That's so cool. So talk a little bit about, I mean, you graduated in the mid-90s. What's marketing look like in the mid-90s?
Well, so you know, the internet really was not even started yet at that time. So I graduated and had actually not studied anything about marketing. And it turned out that that was the perfect background to have in marketing when the internet came around, because there was so much baggage for people to forget from kind of traditional marketing when you suddenly had this great area to experiment and measure and all of these things that were a lot harder in kind of the non-internet world. So my couple of years in sales really taught me the power of numbers and trying different things. And that was just a really good background to go into this online marketing world and really help to kind of invent what would work to acquire customers.
What's interesting also is that like the metrics by which you can measure success are so different. I mean, just think about that. I mean, you know, now we're, you know, 20 plus years later, right? And, you know, it used to be that, let's say a company would say, I'm going to throw up a billboard, right? I'm going to throw up a billboard on Route 95. And there are a lot of cars there. And how would you ever know if someone came to your business because of the billboard or because maybe you had a Yellow Page ad? I mean, I guess that
right.
was, right? So it must be kind of cool now to see that so much of this is measurable, right?
Right. And what was interesting is in the early days of the internet, most people really weren't measuring it. They were literally putting up billboards on the internet and not tracking. They might track like what their click-through rate was on the ad, but they weren't looking at ultimately, for every dollar I spend, how many dollars do I generate? And that's obviously the big question, because you're going to be wasting a lot of money if you're not real careful with it. And so that was, I think, a big advantage for us, is that we had a great development team in Eastern Europe, and they were a lot cheaper than what a lot of the US-based companies had. So I could help to leverage that into marketing, where they built really good tracking systems and just really helped me be super efficient in how we spent money to grow that business.
Side benefit is that you learned how to make chicken paprikash when you got back. So that was excellent.
I definitely learned how to eat it.
Given that there is all this data, then what is the crisis that's occurring in the marketing world? Why is there a crisis?
So part of the crisis is that actually everybody has gotten a lot smarter. And as a result, everybody has started to experiment and measure and jump into channels as they emerge. And what's happened now on the internet, at least, you have opportunities that dry up in a matter of, you know, weeks, where it used to be you could do the same thing for a couple of years, and once you discovered something that worked, you could ride that for a long time. Everybody's getting more efficient, jumping into these different channels, and now what works for you this week might not work in another month or two. So you have to be much more experimental, and you have to really take, once you've gotten someone's attention and consideration for your product, you have to manage that person all the way through becoming a super passionate customer with your product. And that's where it gets hard.
So once you have the user, the customer, what is it? I feel like maybe because it's so easy to change, how do you create a stickiness? How do you keep that customer excited about what you're doing? In other words, if I'm Uber and I got everyone psyched in the beginning, but now, you know, I'm a jackass like Travis Kalanick, and now I've got 14 other, but I've got like so many other options in almost every market. So how do I keep you enthusiastic about what I'm doing?
Yeah, so the first thing that you want to do is, as we talked about, this must-have score kind of research, of essentially finding out what does a super passionate customer look like, and everything you're doing is essentially trying to get more people to that state. What Uber has done, what Facebook has done, what some others have done, have actually started to quantify this great experience with their product, so they can figure out what more value to their customers looks like. And everything they're doing when they're running these experiments is trying to expand what this value to their customer looks like across that customer base. And that's what drives, essentially, what drives retained customers is when you understand what value means to them and you do a better and better job of delivering it. And that's also what drives referral. And I think that's one of the big changes as well, is that you have all of these connected customers now because they're all on the internet, and word of mouth spreads faster than it ever has. So the more that you focus on delivering a great experience, the more you focus on keeping people and empowering them to spread the word.
Before we let you go, talk about just in like very quickly, what's the ability for, say, a big established brand to growth hack? Like if you're Walmart, what do you do?
So that's where it starts to get hard, because a lot of the levers of growth, the really powerful things that you can do to accelerate growth, actually don't sit in the marketing department. They sit in the product team. You know, things like that first customer experience on your product, or things that you can do to drive referral in your product, they sit in the product team. And so you have this legacy organization where groups are organized in silos, but the customer journey goes across these. The customer doesn't care what silo it is.
Yeah, right.
But it's very fragmented internally of how you manage that. So I think companies are working really hard to try to figure out how to integrate a customer-centric approach to this experimentation. But I haven't really seen a big company do very well with it yet. But I've talked to a lot of them, and I was at Microsoft earlier this week. I did a workshop for L'Oreal a couple of months ago. You've got these companies that are really focused on trying to figure it out, and I'm sure the smart ones are going to, because it's just so powerful when you look at the growth in the valuation of companies like Facebook, that's now $400 billion, or even Uber, despite their mistakes. It's a very valuable company in the eyes of the shareholders and Airbnb, and they've all taken this very customer-centric approach to experimentation, and with something like a growth team. And so that's, I think that you will see it probably a little differently in these more legacy companies, but they're going to figure it out.
Sean Ellis, I think the way they do it is to hire you. He's the author of Hacking Growth, How Today's Fastest Growing Companies Drive Breakout Success. Thank you so much for joining us here on Jill on Money. Go check out the book. It's cool. Or go to the website. That's easy to do. Go to growthhackers.com. Okay, you're listening to Jill on Money. 855-411-JILL. Send us an email. AskJill@JillOnMoney.com. We'll be right back.
Have a question? Call anytime, 24-7, 855-411-JILL. Back to Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger.
Well, come on, let's go.
You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, we'd love to hear from you. Our phone number here is 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, AskJill@JillOnMoney.com. And we love getting your emails, especially the nice lengthy ones. It kind of gives us the color commentary on what's going on in your life, which is helpful. So, okay, Nicholas writes that he is 27, he's debt-free. I'm renting, so no mortgage at the moment. I will be getting married in July of this year. My fiance will be bringing her student loans of about $39,000. That's like the opposite of a dowry. I want to tackle this as quickly as possible. I'm looking for advice on when it makes sense to refinance these And if I have a better, and if I have better credit than her, can, should I co-sign with her to help with the interest after we are married? Mark's shaking his head no, but let's get more information about Nicholas. He makes $45,000 a year. His fiance is into photography. She wants to do it full time when she gets clients. That's not an easy business, just FYI. She's also going to grab a part-time job until her business fully takes off. She just graduated in December. I paid off my car loan in December of 2015, and it certainly changed the way I viewed money. I learned a lot with podcasts and books. I sold all of my stocks from my various stock purchase plans, started saving the money I was paying on the car. I fully funded a Roth IRA. How about that? Bought an engagement ring, funded an emergency reserve fund. Guy's turned his life around, $45,000 a year. I contribute 6% to get my company 401k match. I put 4% into my Roth. I have $10,000 saved for emergency funds in a savings account. I'm also currently saving toward the deductible for my car insurance and my health insurance. Started a health savings account with work, matches up to $350. And I can invest in Vanguard funds after $1,000 is already in the account. I already hit that goal, so I'm investing with a target date fund there. I plan on keeping that account for when I retire for my health expenses. Thank you for your great advice on the podcast. It's helpful and enjoyable to listen to. Huh. Okay, let's start from the top. Mark, what do you say? You want him to co-sign to refinance those loans? No, he doesn't. I don't either. I don't think you need to refinance the. First of all, don't co-sign, because there's no need to do that. Okay, you're better off just helping her attack the debt. So what you really want to look at is what are each of the student loans that she has. You want to create a list, and you're the best way that you can help her achieve the goal of paying these down in the short run is to just get organized around it. So you want to just create a nice little spreadsheet for yourself. Here's the loan, right? Here's the interest rate. Here is the monthly payment. And this is the term of the loan. And you're going to format this from the highest interest rate to the lowest interest rate. And you're going to take a look at what all these, you know, essentially what is the combined interest cost. I don't think it necessarily makes a ton of sense to refinance this unless you're going to make a big change in the interest. And $39,000 is a lot, but it's not so much that you're really going to get crushed under this debt. Maybe you'll make a few bucks from the wedding. Maybe you can pay some of the higher interest debt down from the wedding proceeds. That would be a nice thing to do. You can help her out if you'd like, but I don't think that refinancing is going to make a ton of sense right this second. Again, it depends. If all of a sudden you told me you had, 18% loans, then sure. But it really, considering she just graduated in 2016, I don't know whether these are federal or private loans. I certainly wouldn't want you to combine them and refinance with a private provider. If she were to maybe have an opportunity to use some of the government plans for consolidation or income-based repayment. But I think right now, organized, let her take care of it. Maybe the best thing that you can do, Nicholas, is say to her, any money that you make is what you should pay, just put it right down on the loans. And I will float the household expenses until you get a full-time gig. How about that? Maybe that's the best way to approach it. But I really, listen, guys, when you co-sign loans, whether it's parents co-signing with students and vice versa, or your mates, there's no good reason to do it. It's just like something bad happens, then both of your credit gets trashed. And as my friend John Alzheimer says, hey, we got to get Alzheimer on the show again soon. He is a credit expert. There is no benefit of having these loans being co-signed or owning a joint credit card because you're just spreading out the risk between the two of you. The reason why people tend to need to have both of you signing on a mortgage is because we need the income, generally speaking, and it does give some sense of, how shall we say, security, especially if your spouse is not making a ton of money. So again, everything starts with how much do you owe? To whom do you owe the loan? What is the rate? When is it due? Okay? That's the most important thing. And remember that if you do have federal loans, if she has federal loans, you may be eligible for various repayment plans. Those are not available if you have private loans. That's why pushing them all together and refinancing as another private loan, you may not want that. You may actually want to see some of the benefits of the federal plan. And if you combine everything, it's not going to work. So don't do it. All right. So good luck. Thank you so much for writing. And yeah, no combos. Thank you very much. Have you checked out our new podcast, by the way? It's called Better Off. You can get it on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, SoundCloud, anywhere else you find your favorite podcasts. Mark just sent me an article about podcasts and popularity and this, that, and the other thing from the BBC. And they actually did a nice job of laying out exactly what a podcast is and how you do it. But it's really easy, guys. Just hop on over to your anywhere, like iTunes. You just type in Better Off with Jill Schlesinger and you'll start subscribing and you'll get the stuff every week. Okay, 855-411-JILL. That's our phone number. Our email address is askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
It's the weekend, and that can only mean one thing. You're listening to Jill on Money. Here she is, Jill Schlesinger.
You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, we'd love to hear from you. Our phone number is 855-411-JILL. Our email address, askjill@jillonmoney.com. Hey, don't forget to check out our podcast. It's called Better Off. Better Off. You can get it on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, SoundCloud, anywhere else you find your favorite podcasts. And if you've missed any part of this show or want to go check out shows that have run in the past, maybe you heard about a fabulous guest from one of your friends who listens to the show, you can go to our website, jillonmoney.com, click on the radio tab, and we'll get you on the air. Hey, you know what's interesting? I got some fresh data out about the difference between passive and active managed funds. You know, I'm a big passive fan. I used to be an active fan until I realized that the didn't work that well. So Standard & Poor's does this analysis, and they basically say that over the last 15 years, 82% of all actively managed funds have trailed their benchmarks. Now, I just want to put this in perspective. It's not, I mean, some categories it's different than others, but let me give you for an example. Large cap funds over 15 years, 92% lag the index. Of the mid cap funds in the US, 95%. Small cap, 93%. So, yes, I mean, in any given year, you have a couple that might beat, but over the time, guess what? Passive is better. And it tends to be better in those, like, the big crowded types of investment categories, like large cap U.S. growth. But some places where you can find some value that would usually be a more narrowly traded type of market. Maybe it's an international debt fund or something like that. That's where you start to find some outperformance. But by and large, if possible, stick to the passive. Okay, guys? Thanks. Okay, this is from Alex, who wrote to us that he thinks he's going to have to pay a couple $1,000s in federal taxes. He says, I've got two kids. I'm married. My son's 11. My daughter's 20. My daughter lives with us. She's not a student. I have Obamacare. I receive subsidies. My daughter was a full-time student in 2015 and 16, but I don't think I'm going to be able to take an exemption for her, which will reduce you know, his total number of personal exemptions. And he says, I think I'm going to have to repay my subsidies. And I want to know what action I should take to avoid the situation in 2018. So anyway, the answer to this, I think, is not going to be fantastic. I mean, you cannot necessarily declare her as a dependent unless there's she has certain qualifications. And I think it's about, I think she can't earn a certain amount of money, but should check that out. If you are looking like you're going to have an extra $3,000 or $4,000 in payments, what I probably would do right now is look at your overall budget and try to determine where you might be able to squeeze it a tiny bit. Now, presuming you can't do that because that's why you're writing, you might actually have to lighten up on your retirement contributions to pay your tax bill. You're going to have to work it through, but and you may even want to change your withholding a little bit to make sure that it's covered so you don't get a nasty tax bill. In any event, it's, you know, tax season is now behind you. It may be worth your while to go talk to an accountant or a tax preparer just to look at your situation, or a certified financial planner, to simply figure out what's the best thing to go, what is the best strategy going forward to help you avoid that situation. That's tough. I also got a couple of tax questions about long-term care insurance and deductibility of it. You know, just so everyone remembers, I think that there's some confusion. A lot of the deductions that you used to be able to take for your unreimbursed medical expenses, including long-term care insurance premiums, it changed. It has to be more than 10% of your AGI to make it applicable as an itemized deduction, 7.5% if you're over the age of 15, if you're over the age of 65. So 10% if you're over 65, 7.5% if you're under 65. So all of the questions about long-term care insurance costs and deductibility has to do with your specific situation. All right. Hopefully that works. Okay, hold on. Oh, this is an interesting question. I think I'm going to save this one. We'll get back from a break. Be much more fun. Okay, you are listening to Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, we'd love to hear from you. Our phone number here is 855-411-JILL. You can also send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. And remember, if you, after going through the entire process of taxation, and you're going through your taxes and you got them back and you have some questions about ways to maybe adjust going forward and take different actions this tax year as opposed to last tax year, it's a great time to do it. So give us a shout. We'd love to hear from you. Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL. Stay tuned. More of your questions coming up next. You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, we'd love to hear from you. 855-411-JILL. Send us an email. askjill@jillonmoney.com. I've got a great note from Harry in the Denver area who wanted to share his experience with bonds and bond funds. So he says, I know that yield to maturity on bonds. All right, let me just do this. He wrote it in a way that is a little bit more technical that I want to. Okay, so what he's saying is he knows that when you have an old bond, as interest rates rise, you're basically comparing with the old bond you bought with the new bond. So if you've got a 5% of something that's paying you 5%, and interest rates are now 2%, your 5% bond is actually paying you more interest and it's more valuable, right? So that's why bond prices fluctuate. And so to, you know, go kind of the other way, which is when people say, hey, I got a great bond and interest rates are rising and prices are going down. As long as you hold on to your bond, you can just hold it to maturity. You get your principal back. And then you buy new bonds and you get higher rates, and that's good. But here's what Harry writes. It's interesting. Bond fund managers tend to sell old bonds as rates rise and buy new ones. This allows them to advertise that their income rates are higher, which is a competitive advantage over managers who just hold their old bonds to maturity. Now, the selling managers, they create a permanent loss of principal. Yes, you know, albeit they are offsetting that with an increase in income, but for people who want to preserve principal, they should not buy bond funds in a rising interest rate environment because they will lose principal. Yes, they'll get more income, but that loss of principal will sting. Just an FYI. Okay, that's it. Thanks for writing, Harry. And thanks to all of you for listening. It's been a great program. If you've got a question, give us a holler, 855-411-JILL. Always send us emails, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks for listening.